I find it very poignant to end on this presentation in our host city of Boston, and I wasn't able to make the other session on the marathon bombings, and no pressure or anything. This, you know, the last session of a scientific session of the conference, and so I'm really looking forward to this talk, and of course I look forward to all the other ones, but it's just a really nice place to end, I think, our session. And so I'd like to welcome up here Atiyah Martin, who is the director of the Office of Public Health Preparedness at the Boston Public Health Commission. And she is going to give a talk on public health preparedness and interdisciplinary collaboration at the Boston Marathon bombing, a case study. So welcome. Thank you very much.
So first of all, thank you all for having me. I'm hopefully going to make this interesting for everyone. I think what you'll find is that all of the preceding presentations really touch upon everything that I'm going to talk about in terms of practically what happened after the bombings. So the disclaimer, I'm supposed to read it to you. The following personal financial relationships with commercial interests relevant to this presentation existed during the past 12 months. There is no relationship to disclose. So there, I said that. So just to give you context before we jump right into the events, the Office of Public Health Preparedness is within the Executive Office of the Boston Public Health Commission. So I report directly to Dr. Ferrer, the commissioner, as well as working very closely with Boston Emergency Medical Services. So this is my happy work family right here. Everything I'm going to talk about in terms of what our role was done by these people here. So there's not a lot of them, and this is kind of the range of skills and talent abilities on the team is incredible. So before I get into kind of what our office does, I want to highlight the fact that there's some people who couldn't be here today who participated in facilitating after-action meetings that led to our ability to capture all of this data to present to you today. So Stacy Cochram, who's one of my associate directors, Michael Colanti, who's also an associate director, and Mia Allen. So the last person on there who I have in italics, Caitlin Cornelius, is actually here, sitting right there, raise your hand. And I point her out because without her, this wouldn't have been submitted because we were just so busy after the bombings. And so she found a sliver of time to help us craft this proposal to submit. So to give you the full context, the Office of Public Health Preparedness really has six main areas. I'm not going to talk about all of them today, but just to give you a very high-level overview, we have our internal emergency management role for the Boston Public Health Commission with the critical services that we provide to the community, two very large homeless shelters, a methadone clinic. We have Boston EMS as part of our organization. We have a tuberculosis clinic that we own and manage. So we have this whole range of services that have to be continued regardless of what's happening in the city. So that's that public health emergency preparedness piece. And that doesn't include the services that we have to provide as a result of an emergency and the capabilities that we have to be able to support the community with. The second piece of, in terms of, the second one I'm going to talk about, is about healthcare system preparedness and coordinating across the whole diaspora of healthcare that we have to deal with in the city of Boston. There are over 100 partners. I will talk about them here shortly. But there's a lot of work that goes into bringing people together to coordinate, to think about planning, training, exercising, coordinating how we're actually going to do response. So not just the planning piece and, you know, thinking about, you know, on paper, but really what is it specifically that we're going to do when something happens in the city. The training and education piece is really facilitated through the Delvalle Institute for Emergency Preparedness. Since its inception, we've trained over 28,000 first responders, community, public health folk, healthcare partners, emergency managers within the city of Boston, within the region, and within Massachusetts. Community preparedness is another key element of what we do, and this really is a focus on community resilience, particularly community health resilience. I can't get into it today, but there was so much that we talked about that it would be great to share with you at another time. And then really the focus today is really going to be on that public health and medical services response and recovery operations. I always like to touch on admin and finance because we are completely grant funded and there are lots of people who spend a lot of time helping us manage the 13 grants among a lot of different organizations that we receive in order to be able to do the work that you see here. So for the context of our healthcare system here in the city of Boston, I already talked about the Boston Public Health Commission. So we have one municipal ambulance service in the Boston Emergency Medical Services. We have 20 licensed hospitals, six of them level one trauma centers, which was talked about earlier. We have 12 acute care hospitals. We also have 24 community health centers. I always like to point out the first community health center was started here in the city of Boston in Dorchester. And we also have an expansive list of other healthcare partners like long-term care, like home health. We also have a large number of specialty care organizations, and in that category, we like to include our dialysis centers. They also are partners at the table. We also, in that category, include our university health centers. We have a huge body of higher education institutions in the city of Boston, one of the highest concentrations in the country, so we invite our university health centers to the table as well. Last but not least, mental health. So to get into kind of the actual response, everyone knows April 15th, we had two explosions. So for context, the Medical Intelligence Center within the Boston Public Health Commission, working in very close coordination with all of those different partners that I was talking about, we were already activated because that's what we do in terms of any planned event that we have in the city of Boston, particularly one where there's such high medical consequences. So this gives you a kind of a perspective on the first 10 minutes at the top. So the bombings happened. We immediately in the Medical Intelligence Center received radio traffic from one of our staff members who was in 10A that there had been two bombings, and we began to make notifications to our partners at the different hospitals. We posted that to WebEOC, which is one of the technologies that we use to communicate in real time with all of our healthcare partners who were also already activated and paying attention to this incident. Within the first hour, EMS talked about this in the previous presentation earlier. For those people who weren't there, there were 118 transports that happened within the first hour of this response. In total, Boston EMS was responsible for 75 of those transports. And through our mutual aid relationships, we were able to transport another 43 people from the scene within that first hour. So where did they go? So they went to 9 different hospitals. They went to our 6 level one trauma centers, which are highlighted in orange, but they also went to 3 of our other hospitals throughout the city in order to, as part of that distribution of patients, in order to not overburden the medical system within the city of Boston. So this is the Medical Intelligence Center. This is what it looks like in all its glory. This is actually from the day of the bombing. So as you can see, I just want to point out, there's a young lady sitting right there with the bun in her hair with her back to us, and that would be Caitlin Cornelius, who was very involved in the bombing response and recovery efforts. And one thing I want to point out is people are wearing their Adidas jackets with the stripes on them. Those are the BAA issue jackets that people get for volunteering at the marathon. So just to highlight the fact that we had individuals who were actually in the field in these tents along the routes who were then called in and had to work. So there was a lot of sacrifices that happened. We were activated for 2 weeks after the bombings. A full 2 weeks every day, all day long, for 2 whole weeks. A lot of the work that we did really was around this, regardless of what the incident is, there's 3 key roles that we play. Situational awareness, making sure that there's resource coordination through existing agreements that we have across all of the different healthcare partners, but then also that third piece is really around human service coordination in support of that recovery process. So within the Medical Intelligence Center, at any given point, throughout the 2 weeks, there were all of these agencies. So we had the American Red Cross, incredible partners, Boston Athletic Association, really our Boston Healthcare and Preparedness Coalition partners were incredible supporters. So I really don't want to read all of these to you, but these were incredible partners. I really want to thank the Massachusetts Department of Public Health for living in the Medical Intelligence Center with us, with our staff, really helping to make that connection between what was happening in the city of Boston and all of the work that was happening in the rest of the state, and making sure that we could get accurate information about the patients who were impacted by this particular incident, not just from Boston, but from the other healthcare facilities outside the city of Boston. And DPH played a huge role in our ability to do that. The other people I want to make sure I thank is the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They came to us with a public health, mental health team that really helped us to enhance our capacity to support the mental health response after the bombings. So Dr. Ferrer earlier within the other presentation, and I apologize for referring to the earlier presentation, but it makes it easier for me to talk about this quicker. But a lot of the, in the first night of the bombings, we actually set up what she referred to as a community support center, community drop-in center, and that was within the first few hours. It was at the Park Plaza Hotel Castle, which is pictured below, and a lot of the services were about mental health, counseling, sheltering, and providing very basic services like food. And we also had a lot of film unification activities happening in that first night. We continued with those drop-in centers for days after that, after the initial bombings, in order to continue with being able to connect people with to services like mental health counseling. A huge piece of this was just the volume of information that had to be provided to the community. So when you think about the first few days of the bombings, I'm going to start at the bottom and talk about the mayor's hotline, because that is the number that we provided to the community and said, this is where you call if you're looking for a loved one. This is where you call if you need help, if you need any type of resources. And they have a call center where they were quickly able to expand staffing through a plan that we have across all the city agencies. So to give you context, there were over 21,000 calls they received in the course of 11 days. Within those 21,000 calls, over 2,400 of those calls were people who were looking for their loved ones. And so that was in the immediate aftermath of the bombing. So that's in those hours afterwards and into the early morning hours of the following day. So what I think a lot of people don't know is that there was a huge mental health component to the work that was done through the Medical Intelligence Center. We coordinated over 200 sessions to support the community, to support healthcare partners like hospitals who had received a lot of these patients in numbers and quantities that they had never seen before at that acuity level. We also provided support to the Boston Athletic Association, or the BAA, a lot of the first response agencies within the city and within the surrounding jurisdictions. Remember that the race is not just about Boston. So there were other first response agencies who did not necessarily have the types of resources that some of the larger agencies had. So we had to help them supplement the support they needed for their responders. We also had the American Red Cross, who was very key in helping us to enhance our ability to have resources to deploy. We also used our Public Health Commission clinicians to help get this information or get these resources out to people. Again, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, along with the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health. So really there was this wide scope of resources that we were coordinating at the Medical Intelligence Center around mental health support services. We really spent over 600 hours of other people's time, including our own clinicians' time, in order to provide this level of support to the community. So this is kind of what one of those busy days of dealing with everything else. So we're also doing patient tracking at this time. We're doing the support services coordination, but also this mental health specific support coordination. And you can't see this, but on that far whiteboard, there's two whiteboards there. The one on the left, in the middle really, was where we were logging in those requests as they were coming in, because they were coming in so fast and furiously. And then it was going into a fancier system where we could actually kind of do some analysis post-incident. So it was fast and furious. You see we had our American Red Cross representative. We have people in the back there from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We also have an earlier presenter, Katie Keeman, from the Massachusetts Department of Public Health in the back on the far left. You can hardly see her. And that's just half of the mix. The other half was also very full with people as well. So one piece that Dr. Ferrer talked about in some detail was about the Family Assistance Center. This was something that we set up with a number of partners who are too numerous to detail, but many of the partners that I mentioned previously. This was specifically for the survivors and their families, only for the survivors and their families, and we had to keep it away from the media. So miraculously, we had this open for 10 days, starting the Thursday after the bombings, and going 10 days after that, and not one media outlet showed up, so found out. So we were very happy with that. We also had a support from the Seaport World Trade Center, which hosted us very graciously, very last minute, saved our sanity in trying to find a location where we could actually do this. They provided food as well as all the support services we needed in order to have this Family Assistance Center there. We had over 10 different organizations there to provide everything from victim compensation to help with taxes, because April 15th was tax day. Some people hadn't done their taxes, and making sure people didn't get penalized. We had people who were newly homeless because they didn't have access to their previous apartments. We also had a number of people who needed housing remodifications because they did own their home, but the rehabilitation center where they were located at could not release them to their home because it needs some modifications. So there was this whole range of need that people had that we were able to coordinate with a number of different partners, and I just want to really thank the American Red Cross for being so awesome and really being by my side in this Family Assistance Center and really coordinating all of the logistics for the center, as well as providing mental health support services, as well as helping us to coordinate with the disaster case management piece amongst all of these different organizations who had never come together before in this way in this area of the country. So really wanted to highlight that and say thank you to them. All in all, we served over 118 clients. This is survivors as well as their family members that we were providing these services to. We're still providing services to people. We have support groups that are ongoing for the survivors of the bombings and their family members. So it's been an incredible experience. So thank you all very much. I ended on time because I saw my two-minute card come up about a minute ago. So thank you. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
My first question is, how large is your budget? And then my second question is a little more complicated. I'm just going through your presentation. I'm just struck by how, at least from my view, how seamless everything seems to be. Sort of like a textual case of this is how disaster preparedness should look. I'm not ignorant of disaster preparedness, so I'll say that up front. So maybe other things. What percentage of this was just sheer luck that people were able to come in together? Mm-hmm. And what percentage of this is due to the fact that Boston has so many schools, so many hospitals in an area where they all seem to be fairly close together?
Okay, so you gave me a lot. So I'm going to chunk it into two pieces. So the first piece was about budget and funding. So it's hard to, we're completely grant funded and it fluctuates all the time. And so what I can give you for context, we spent about $1.5 million on staffing. So that's the cost of salaries, that's the cost of fringe, and that's also the added cost of indirect because everyone is grant funded. And so we have to pay homage back to the Boston Public Health Commission. So that's to give you context. Anything extra we get, we try to do projects to bring all of these partners together. It is a constant struggle. We come up with new and creative ways all the time. Caitlin can attest to that if you want to harass her afterwards as well. I'm offering up her, and she doesn't even work for us anymore. But we come up with a lot of creative ways to deal with the budget shortfalls, and I think to some extent it's helpful because people aren't fighting over money. We're really getting to the heart of getting the work done, and it takes people to get the work done. So yes, it's nice to have things and toys, and we have this beautiful room, and that's great, but ultimately it's the relationship. It's the people who can actually go to these meetings, coordinate with people, triage the different issues people have around how we're approaching things and really take consensus from these groups and kind of facilitate all of this. So, and we meet not just with at the coalition level. Our office meets with a lot of these disciplines individually each quarter. So we meet with the dialysis center separately. We meet with the community health center separately. We meet with the hospital separately. We meet with the home health organization separately. We meet with all of these people separately because they also have their own unique needs within their disciplines. So it's been an endeavor that requires human resources. So that's kind of the funding piece and really my pitch for, you know, I would love extra funding so I could have more people. So the second part was really around, you know, how, what percentage of this was kind of dumb luck and what percentage of this was really like all the work that went into this. I can't really describe the dumb luck part, but probably because I'm a little bit biased, I think, and partly because things happen so fast that it's really hard to be able to take it out to the so abstract. But what I can tell you is that the most important thing that we saw in terms of what made this as successful as it was, taking into account that this was a horrible incident, and taking into account that, you know, limited resources and everything was crazy in the city, was the relationships, and that we had been working on this stuff for years. This is not new. Before Atiyah came along, they were doing this work. So really what we did was really kind of expanded the different healthcare disciplines that we were working with, and we really really asked people the hard questions about response. How are we going to do this response piece? And I think having those discussions allows you to, when something happens, for it not to be a new conversation. We do have a charter for our coalition, so our members do sign off on a charter. It's not legally binding. As you mentioned, some people have come up with some really creative ways. We came up with some really creative ways in order to structure our coalition in order to be able to facilitate this as well. So that's one of the reasons why we have such large representation within our coalition. And it ties directly back to the Medical Intelligence Center and the services that they get from the Medical Intelligence Center when we activate it.
And I'm from Philadelphia. And I'll tell you the two things that they said to me was the response that they received from the people who total strangers was phenomenal in terms of the help they gave them to make them feel better. And the second thing was that they saw the city, it was unbelievable what help they received so that they felt safe and they felt secure, especially in an environment where you could very easily not feel secure.
Thank you very much.
I want to just open it up also in general for any of the panelists if you have questions.
So I have a question for Ms. Mueller. You were right.
She's actually my student. She wasn't able to be here.
Okay. So I was asking So if I heard correctly, it was a very interesting definition of community resilience, which was a self-sufficiency where able to recover without federal assistance, and I couldn't remember if you said state assistance, but I think it was a self-sufficiency.
It is completely self-sufficient
to recover
model.
Without, and I was so, and I'm like, that's like optimal. But what I was wondering is, does that factor in if there's an impact to child care, Head Start, a safe place to meet children, impacted housing, impact economic loss, job loss, transportation loss. Does it factor in all of that as far as self-sufficiency? And is there in the plan a plan for surge if that assistance is needed?
I'm going to try to address those myriad issues, which I don't think I'll be able to do all. I caught the child care services. And what's interesting is a lot of the churches actually offer child care services on a regular basis. So they have toys, they have all of those supplies for children. And what we actually said in terms of reunification, churches would probably be the first places, if, for example, if an earthquake hit in the middle of the day, and the parents are at work, the schools, the children are at school, that would probably be the first place that parents would show up to find their kids. Just because that kind of is the center for that community. Now what we did find, a lot of those churches, or that community, they are commuter churches. So for example, some congregation members may live maybe 30 minutes away, and they may drive on Sundays to that church. That is a whole other aspect that we actually did not address, because it's the center for the community, but it may not be the center for certain congregation members.
And I think in like long term, like even after Sandy, or there's still even actually families that have been impacted in Katrina, Sandy a year later, still families
right.
that have
Well, I mean, that's obviously an important question. What is interesting, I think all of the six churches actually, they offered shelter for Hurricane Katrina victims. So they, and it's part because of that large network that they are a part of, and so they got word that there were some family members who, you know, they had nowhere to go. They said, bring them in, we'll take care of them. They housed them for 2 weeks until they were able to make some arrangements where they were able to find housing with a family member. But they housed them for 2 weeks, and they said the response was overwhelming, where congregation members would bring in clothes, food, toys for the kids. It was just a completely overwhelming response. So I think, again, it's things that they have thought of, they know they have to do, and it's one of those things where there's just this complete faith that, you know, if the time comes, if there's a need for it, then congregation members are just going to do it. But our hope with this was that we kind of opened their eyes to, it's great to have faith, and most likely that will happen, but it's also important to have that plan and to at least start that conversation going.
Can I just add to that? Sorry. Just very quickly, I just wanted to add to that that one of the other pieces that has been, from a local perspective, has been really important has been making sure that we're working with the faith-based organizations and with community-based organizations, with these some of the other organizations, particularly private sector, who work in the city of Boston, because of the fact that we're trying to avoid silos being created. And so making sure that everyone understands what resources the city can offer them, what resources they can facilitate with the state and with the federal government, manage expectations, but also that two-way piece, because government can't do it all, as was mentioned before, and that we understand kind of what resources they're willing to bring to bear and how we can support them in strengthening their emergency plans and their thinking about how they can support their own congregations. And so really that two-way street of we all have things to offer each other, and when you look at whole community approach, at least, you know, very quickly from my perspective, that community resilience piece isn't just that the community, as in the individuals and organizations within the community, but that all of us, local government, these faith-based, community-based organizations, private sector, that we're on the same page and that we're resilient together. So just want to put that out there.
So I think, thank you very much. I think we have time for one or two more questions. I'm going to have great restraint and not ask my thorough health department and then also your local health department.